How the Great Wealth Transfer Could Lead to the Great Bitcoin Adoption. We got Pete Rizzo on the show today for an awesome crypto economy chat. What is up, guys? Thank you for joining us. This is the Crypto Economy. I'm Guy Swan. Thank you to Swan Bitcoin for supporting us. That's Swan with one N. There's still pending litigation over whether or not this is a trademark violation on my name. Thank you to Bitcoin for giving us some measure of reliability in these very, very weird times. No matter how many dollars or corona tests there are, you know, there will only be 21 million Bitcoin. So, no better time than now to start a dollar cost averaging into the soundest money in the world. SwanBitcoin.com, baby. So I don't know how everybody else has been doing. I hope everybody has been enjoying quarantine. The whole globe has been quarantined. But I have had a lot of opportunities to do some video editing and do a lot of reading, so that's good. There was a report dropped on the Kraken blog about the Great Wealth Transfer. And it's basically, the idea is that they got into, their research team over there got into some real specifics, like that they could pinpoint, that suggest even if we held everything else constant, there's actually pretty good evidence to think or to consider that we could still see $1 trillion worth of value move into the Bitcoin system in the next couple of decades, just kind of accounting for the inheritance and move of wealth from the boomer generation down to the millennials and Gen X generations. But there's a lot of charts and a lot of data, so I kind of felt like it wouldn't go over so well as an audio version. So kind of made sense just to bring somebody on the show. And that is what we did. We got Pete Rizzo on the show today. Had a awesome discussion towards the end of last week. I tried to cram in as many questions as I had thought up during reading this article as I could. But I think you guys are really, really going to enjoy this one. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into this crypto economy chat with Pete Rizzo from the Kraken team. We got Pete, is it Rizzo?
Rizzo, yep.
Okay, that's how I've always thought of it, because when Alex mentioned you, I was like, oh snap, I know that name. Yeah, let's have him on the show.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. I read the report, which we'll get into in just a minute, but before we do, give me your background. I want to hear kind of where you came from and how you ended up at Kraken and kind of what your specialty is now, like what you're focusing on.
Yeah, sure. My name is Pete Rizzo. I'm editor at large at Kraken. Most people know me as the former editor in chief for CoinDesk. I was with CoinDesk for, as I said, about 6 years, helping that company grow from, a loose group of people who happen to be on Skype with a good idea for what might be a media source to, what was eventually a 40, 50 person plus company with, outposts around the globe. So, most people know me as a writer there and a public face on videos and things that we produced, but, definitely was more behind the scenes as time went on and that organization grew. But, since the start of this year, I've been at Kraken full time. Been excited about that. I think, definitely my transition in this space has been one from more of a journalist, trying to kind of like hold accountable people in the industry and, start conversations to, really kind of thinking how can I help play a role in adoption, because I guess I like to say I reached a point, I think, where I was probably just about as confused as everybody else and had to figure out what to do with that, when that time came.
Awesome. Have you read Corey Clipston on some Swan Bitcoin had one about like just kind of talking about the idea of adoption, about the 10 million Bitcoiners, about kind of trying to theorize on what the limit of like how many Bitcoiners do we need in the US to like hit the hit that tipping point or whatever.
I haven't read that, but it sounds interesting.
It's a good little piece. It's kind of the whole, it's an extension of the whole minority rule. Is that like, what is that minority that we need to basically start the wave? Which will be really interesting in the context, I think, of this research that you've done.
Right.
First, like kind of what led you, was this something that you had just been planning on doing? Like the specific idea come from?
Yeah, so definitely want to clarify, I'm speaking on behalf of the report authors. So, you know, Kraken definitely very privacy and security focused. You know, I do manage and oversee our research publication, but definitely speaking on behalf of, you know, a lot of people whose work was, you know, super important to this. And yeah, so the idea for the report, and just to kind of give the overview, you know, it focuses on the great wealth transfer and how that could give Bitcoin a $1 trillion boost. So really what we wanted to do with this report, you know, was looking at, I think everybody in crypto has a vague impression that, you know, younger generations are going to be a bit more savvy with this technology, that they're a bit more friendly to cryptocurrency. They understand it a bit more intuitively. And that, you know, I think most people have this idea that over time, you know, these demographic shifts are going to cause benefits and hopefully the adoption of cryptocurrency. So we wanted to take this vague impression that people had, and we really wanted to supply, you know, hard data for that, right? So it was about examining authoritative sources and, you know, coming to something that was like a reasoned estimate of what this transition might look like. Because I think the thing with price estimates and things like that is it's, you know, there's a lot of people who kind of shoot from the hip with that stuff.
yeah.
So again, it's about taking this idea that I think everybody in Bitcoin has this idea that, you know, it's going to take time for the industry to grow, adoption will come with time, and saying like, okay, if we accept these things as true, what can we look at to, again, sort of supply something that looks like a numerical contextualization of that.
Mm-hmm. So like where's the concrete data that we could actually look at for capital that potentially could find its way into the system?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's a lot of data on that, right? So like a certain amount of wealth, you know, in the United States transitions annually from elder people to other generations, right? And that money is generally taxed at a certain rate. So, you know, the US government has all these resources where you can kind of, you know, look, and then the full report has charts that kind of go into this. You know, and I think the other thing I would mention is that, you know, wealth management is definitely something that happens over time. You know, there's a lot of tax implications. A lot, you know, older people might start doing this, you know, even when they're relatively younger, because there are certain benefits to it. So the idea was kind of trying to chart, okay, if this transition is going to happen, you know, it's not like it happens all at once. It's going to start gradually and then accelerate. Is there a way we can benchmark that? Is there a way we can tie that to some estimates that, you know, let's say Bitcoin does, you know, go from an aspiring safe haven asset to a real safe haven asset. Let's say, you know, this group of people decides to put X percentage of their wealth in that because, you know, we're assuming that Bitcoin will be more competitive in that space at that time. You know, how does that tweak the numbers? And again, yeah, the report really only looks at the US. That's the other thing. So there are some big numbers in the report. You know, again, the kind of the headline is almost $1 trillion transferring by 2040 in the 2040s. But again, this is just the U.S., right? This is just money transitioning from older generations to younger generations in the U.S.
Yeah, that's kind of what I liked about how many authors of the report were there, actually? You mentioned that there were others or that you were speaking on behalf of them. I didn't quite realize that. I don't think I...
Oh, yeah, sure. So, you know, I'm not sure it's a big secret. Kraken, big company, got over 800 employees today around the world, about 70 open job positions. You know, our research team is about, you know, 5 to 6 people, I think, currently. You know, I'd love to see that kind of grow with time. But yeah, you know, I think, you know, we're definitely starting to think at Kraken about, you know, how to play a bigger role in the conversation around, Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. I think we've always been a company that's been very aligned with the ethos of the community. And I think this report was kind of a good example of something where, you know, how can we can put data around things that are the topic of conversation. So I think that was where and obviously a report like this, two or three months can take to put something like this together. So definitely something we were thinking on for a while.
Yeah, it's a pretty serious piece of a collection of data there. And kind of what I like about it was that it was kind of the opposite approach that I would normally take. I'm more like grandiose and just love to get into extrapolating into all potential. And it's like, this was like super focused on what could we really estimate as like some sort of, again, concrete amount of money, and like how can we relate it to data that we see today, or like perspectives that we can measure to some degree. Right. And extend that out over a period of time with a very specific market, in the US being the example.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing I like about it is that, it takes an extrapolation, and then, it shows how large like conservative estimates are, right? So we have this idea that Bitcoin, people are saying like, oh, there's a million, Bitcoin could be worth $1 million, like blah, 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 blah. It's hard to kind of, get to the point of like, okay, well, what are the rational conditions under which that takes place, right? So one of the things that I liked about the report is if you look at it, it's, if you assume that 1% of this money that's going to transfer in the US between generations, we assume 1% of that money is going to get put into, Bitcoin at a certain tax allocation. It's still, and I think it was about, I think like something like 1% or something like that, it's still a $70,000 Bitcoin, right? That's the amount of the, in order for the, because the supply is limited, right, and we're putting more money into the overall network, that's still a big boost from where we are today.
Right? Yeah.
So, I thought that lens was cool because I think, I see a lot of reports kind of trying to project like a certain price. And I think what's cool about this is like, you're able to look at a range and say that, okay, well, if anything in this range holds true, there's still a big impact.
Yeah. Yeah. to get one concrete, I think it actually reinforces the, it gives more credence to the more exaggerated predictions, because like you can look at something concrete and specific and be like, okay, well then here's one piece of the whole puzzle, and we can clearly have some sort of a range of possible expectation. It's like, what are the other, you immediately start kind of looking out like, what are the other pieces of that puzzle that could, drive continued growth and kind of the wealth and value within the ecosystem.
Yeah, absolutely.
It actually starts right off, and this is an idea that that I've always found fascinating, was that Bitcoin is, you kind of have to be a polymath to really understand Bitcoin, that it's such a multifaceted technology. Kind of wanted to ask, do you think that that's a really big hurdle here? Like, do you think that's like something that will slow this down, or you see it as kind of irrelevant in kind of the grander picture?
That's an interesting question. I think that, I'm amazed by people who are able to come to Bitcoin and then emerge with concrete conclusions as someone who's been in the industry for about 6 years. I think that, one of the things with new technology that's really striking is that, it tends to be many things to many different people. And of course, over the years in Bitcoin, we've seen like clashes of those ideologies. I think Bitcoin can be understood in many different ways. There's a quote that I really like from Douglas Adams that kind of gets to this, which is like, first we thought, and I'm paraphrasing here, it's like, first we thought the internet was a typewriter, so our computers were typewriters, and then we thought that they were, something else, and then the internet, we realized they're brochures or something like that. I wish I had the full quote with me, but, it sort of gets to the idea that, you can look at the computer as a calculator, you can look at it as a brochure, you can look at it as an online library, and like what the issue here was is that we lacked sort of the definitional language to describe the internet, and therefore came up with all these analogies that were, of course, imperfect, right? In trying to describe what the technology achieved, it ended up taking a very small piece of it and trying to use that to articulate its benefits. And I think that on a larger scale, that's what we see with Bitcoin, right? Like, we're unable to really describe what it is. And it's a failure of language, I think, in a lot of ways that people aren't able to understand it well. And I think, you know, certainly with wearing my journalist hat, I think that, you know, I've been skeptical of attempts by people to, I think, you know, try to constrain what Bitcoin is to certain things that are perhaps like maybe a narrow definition than it deserves. So I guess that's my way of saying that I think, you know, I always like to tell people that I think Bitcoin is something that we as society are in the process of understanding. And I don't think that we really know what it is today. I don't think like even the experts really understand it well. And I think that's really, again, another example of why it's so powerful.
Yeah, that's, I love that analogy though, that like, you know, first we thought, I'm going to see if we can find that quote and I'll put it in the show notes or something, but thought the computer was a typewriter and then a calculator and stuff. Like, we were always trying to fit this.
Yeah, I've got, actually, I pulled it up. Yeah, I can read it.
Oh, you found it? Yeah. Let's read the whole thing. That'd be great.
Yeah, at first we thought the PC was a calculator. Then we found out how to turn numbers into letters with ASC2, and we thought it was a typewriter. Then we discovered graphics, and we thought it was a television. With the World Wide Web, we realized it's for sure.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, again, yeah, I think it's a cool quote because it sort of shows that, you know, again, like the failure of the internet within like that quote is not that it isn't powerful, it's that language doesn't conform to, you know, what it is. You know, the reason that we say internet today and we, you know, we're really just using a word to describe many things and we understand it as something finite, but I always think that's kind of an interesting thing that maybe doesn't get enough airplay, is just, you know, the interplay between language and technology is just, you know, we just don't really have the linguistics yet to describe what's going on in cryptocurrency.
Yeah, particularly with how this technology moves, it's kind of like this ever evolving and readjusting thing. Just like the internet in a lot of ways, is that like we're going to figure out new ways to use it constantly. And
right, yeah, you see this with, you know, Bitcoin as a safe haven today, right? Like, you know, is it a safe haven? Is it not a safe haven? You know, is it better to think of Bitcoin as a startup that's an aspiring safe haven, right? There's like a lot of different flavors of things. You know, I've never really fallen into the camp of being someone who wanted it to be like, I don't know, there's different ways to evangelize, right? And I think that the easiest way to evangelize something is always to condense an idea into a form where it's easily repeatable and it lacks nuance. And I feel like at every point in which I've seen anyone do that in cryptocurrency, it's really proven to be a terrible idea for them to do that.
All right. Let's go ahead and so this whole report, the research is really focused around the great wealth transfer, as it's referred to. And this is basically from the boomer generation and the previous generations to the millennials and Gen X, right?
Yeah.
Kind of walk me through what the great wealth transfer is, like how this is going to play out, like what do we see over the next 20 years or so, and how we really kind of came to that $1 trillion number?
Yeah, that's a great question. The $1 trillion number is that, you know, you can quantify the intergenerational like wealth, you know, of the baby boomer generation, right? So again, so, this report really bases itself on demographic study, right? So there's all this larger research done in marketing and advertising to quantify, okay, well, you know, producing new people every year, like how do we put them in a group and understand demographic trends about them, right? So I guess we're at a very high level, if people aren't familiar, you know, myself, I'm a millennial. My parents are, I think, at the later stages of the baby boom generation. You know, younger people now would be in the Gen Z crowd. So, you know, this is kind of an established tactic in marketing and advertising to sort of divide you know, people into sort of arbitrary demographics. And the reason that they can do that is because, you know, it's, you know, generally people, when we're produced in bunches and sort of, you know, all interact with each other, we come to certain conclusions and trends, and we have certain consumer behavior points, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess the wealth transfer here really is just saying that, you know, the baby boom generation is aging, you know, eventually, you know, they will get old and unfortunately pass away. And that when they do so, you know, they'll do what every generation does, which is pass wealth to their children. So, you know, I think we estimated the total wealth transfer of this to be about $70 trillion, or a little bit, you know, less than that. And the $1 trillion was really just if we're taking a sort of average midpoint of this transition, and saying, you know, if, you know, the middle of the possible tax allocation for this money, the middle of the possible, you know, rate at which this group might invest in Bitcoin, what is that midpoint number? So again, we can quantify the total number, we can quantify the demographics, and really our kind of piece here is to extrapolate, okay, well, based on, you know, consumer sentiment by generation about cryptocurrency, what might be the likely percentage that these newer generations will allocate, you know, to Bitcoin potentially.
All right, we're really about to dig into the meat of this. Let's go ahead and take a break, hit our sponsor, and jump back in.
Now, there were a lot of different statistics. This is a little bit off because you were trying to assess like where the money is now and kind of like measuring the growth, because that was one thing that was interesting is the number of data points that y'all had of like continued growth, even though we're not quite seeing it in the price, like of like 2018, 2019, where one would look at like a price chart and see, okay, has this ecosystem really grown?
But then there's certainly a lot of ways to describe the Bitcoin network and how it's being used, right? I think one of the most fascinating battles of Bitcoin's history is about the definition of who is a user, why are they using it, and is the network succeeding against any sort of goal? You know, I like to subscribe to, I'm not sure if you ever follow the blog, blogger's name is Udeon, but he has this nice quote that Bitcoin is, and I think that's probably the best distillation of what is powerful about Bitcoin, is that, you know, the network itself continues to propagate despite all odds, and that is because it is succeeding at, you know, its own almost... you know, it succeeds at its own survival, basically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a lot of charts in here that basically just help contextualize, you know, for newer people, you know, coming and thinking about Bitcoin for the first time, that, you know, this is a network that's been around for 10 years. You know, you can even take a slice of, you know, well, the amount of computers they're dedicating computing power to mining is consistently going up. And, you know, you can really, you know, again, every part of Bitcoin, I think, is, you know, you can divide it, and it's almost like a school of study into itself, right? So what is happening and why are there more mining machines being devoted to Bitcoin? Well, you know, what people are deciding is that, you know, in the market for expending their energy from their computers on something, they're continually choosing to expend that energy on securing Bitcoin blocks and for the promise of being rewarded with new Bitcoin on the assumption that it will go up in value. So, you know, even taking a small data point like that, I think it's important for new people to remember, it's like, that's a huge component of Bitcoin. It is itself a huge market. And, you know, even if we might not see people spending, buying things with Bitcoin today, you know, Bitcoin is many markets unto itself. And it does have some foundational markets that, might not be really easily understood by people making decisions about, you know, their wealth allocation at this point.
Gotcha. Yeah. I love that you mentioned Beauty on one of my favorite, we've read like, I don't know, I guess I've read 4 or 5 pieces from their, from
his stuff has held up pretty well.
Yeah. Yeah. I really love, one of my favorite pieces is Bitcoin and software reliability. Just talking about like it's his breakdown of like this is mission critical software. Like you don't put arbitrary features into, you know, the the firmware that takes you to the moon,
the space shuttle
firmware sort of thing. But I loved that concept. It's one of my favorite pieces.
Yeah, I think what he really provided, you know, when I think back, like I was always interested in his writing, and I think he really, I always loved how he used like sort of ancient, like Roman sort of iconography and like, you know, just sort of like the struggle of Bitcoin and like the, the talking about it as like, you know, Bitcoin's goal is to self-sustain. It like doesn't care about your goals per se. You know, like the network is unto itself a sovereign thing.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I credit that a lot to kind of bringing me down that rabbit hole. And I think Aiken is a really great guy. So
nice. There was something in the research that I actually just wanted to ask to clarify.
Sure.
Was AUM said it was 18.9 billion, which was up from like the $200 million range in 2016 and early 2017. Is the AUM the amount of money like held with custodians that like we can like get information from, like as far as exchanges, custodians and that sort of thing? Is that what that number is?
That's a good question. Let me look that up. So,
because I was wondering if that meant that essentially all the other Bitcoin value, because at $19 billion, you know, that would mean that you've got like
100... the crypto funds. Yeah. So the crypto funds chart is that. So there, yeah, there's two charts there. There's the Bitcoin address balance account. So that one is just looking at what's the dollar value of the Bitcoin, you know, sort of stored in those addresses. So like thinking about that as like an assets under management by the network. And then the other one was looking at like crypto funds based on, you know, some crypto fund research that's been done. So that sort of broke it up between.
Okay. And so it's kind of an aggregate of that data.
Yeah. So one is looking at the network and the other is looking at, you know, because you can assume some things about crypto funds, right? You can assume that they're investing for the future. You can assume that they might be doing something like wealth management on behalf of clients and individuals. So, you know, you can kind of think of them as two distinctive things. One is that more, you know, we can see that more people are using Bitcoin to like hold money there. And then the other one is we can see like we can just assume a bit more things about this group because we understand them. They have definable characteristics. Yeah.
Got you. Okay. This might be a little bit, obnoxious of a question. just in the context that we talked about, you know, the computer wasn't a typewriter, it wasn't a calculator, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But just in your perspective, like kind of having been here for quite some time and see this evolve and kind of be in that position of, do we really understand it? What do you think is the dominant driver of value in this ecosystem? Maybe for now or maybe in the future?
That's an interesting question. Like, what do you mean by driver of value exactly?
Maybe what the dominant use case is, like what is it that this ecosystem has that stands out in context of all other assets?
I think I can answer that because I think, and I was talking about this with someone recently, it took me a while to become a Bitcoiner. You know, I was thinking about this recently, like having been in the space for a while, I don't think I actually was a Bitcoiner early on. As someone who was a journalist and came to the industry because it was exciting and it was a great place to tell stories, I don't think that I really crossed over into really believing in Bitcoin until, I think the ideology and the use cases were a little bit more ironed out. So, for example, I always found like spending Bitcoin and like Bitcoin as a payment method to be sort of unrelatable. I didn't really understand why we needed a system like Bitcoin to accomplish that. And I found that I had trouble like in the big, you know, sort of fork war drama, identifying with the side that like wanted to, you know, have Bitcoin compete at the point of sale, right? Because the thing with, you know, Bitcoin for shopping and Bitcoin for spending is like, you know, I think it was really important early on for the currency. And I don't want to, you know, shortchange the individuals who engaged in that and did that because I think, you know, to a large extent, they helped spread the technology. Like, you know, people like Evan Andreessen gave away you know, what are now millions of dollars in Bitcoin, you know,
those people. Faucets.
Yeah. And I think that what they did was really important at the time. I think that, you know, what we sort of learned from the fork war era was that, you know, when you reduce Bitcoin's value proposition to competing against other payment networks, it's like, well, you have to make certain trade-offs that might be undesirable, and they actually might, you know, reduce some of the characteristics of Bitcoin that are unique. And I think, you know, really what we saw with that big fork war conversation was, you know, I think the industry was forced to consider what are the unique properties of Bitcoin that we want to preserve. And I think, you know, it wasn't until we got to the definition, and look, I think some people like Boudian and others were really early in defining this, but, you know, this mm-hmm. idea that Bitcoin is itself a sovereign currency, that it is a non-governmental currency, and that it's defining, you know, proposition then is that, you know, keeping your wealth in Bitcoin is a form of exit.
Yeah.
I found that very identifiable, because I think, and I think you're seeing, you know, this is why we're seeing Bitcoin maximalism kind of socially scale. And I think it's because, you know, millennials, talking about demographics a little bit again, millennials, Gen X, I think we're people who we like lifestyle choices that like make us feel good about ourselves, right? We like ethical, consumerism. We like want to make sure our money is going in good places. And I think that where the sort of Bitcoin as a payment method group struggled was, I don't think that they were really able to, there wasn't a cause there, right? The cause of you saving like a percentage on a merchant transaction, like, wasn't really.
Oh, I lost you. Pete.
Oh, sorry about that. I think I hit mute by accident.
I lost you at there wasn't like a grand mission or whatever in.
Oh yeah, yeah. With using cryptocurrencies as a payment method, I don't think there was like a, what I was basically saying was like, I don't think that was a cause anybody would die for, right? Like, so
yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah.
You're, you know, you're saving a 0.5% on a merchant transaction.
Yay.
You know, I think like, whereas with Bitcoin maximalism, where it's like, you know, we're trying to win back, you know, the control of money from states, and we're trying to, you know, preserve monetary freedoms that have been reduced or eroded. You know, I think that there's a reason that you're seeing that become more scalable. I think it's because it's a stronger intellectual body of work than the other side.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that it's a much more profound goal. That's just kind of interesting that you put it that way, particularly with like the younger generations, because I think I agree, but I hadn't really thought about whether or not that was true, that they are looking for a more ethical, it's kind of like they're searching really hard for their meaning, you know, like they want to play an important role.
Young people are really into this idea that consumerism like helps define us. It's actually interesting. Like, I think that maybe that's something that ages out of us as we get older. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you think about, you know, I'll be interested to see how future historians look at this, because I think in America, what's kind of odd that you have with capitalism is that young people sort of define themselves through their consumer choices, because they don't. That's the easiest way they have to express ideology, right? So you buy music, you buy clothes, you would do certain things, you wear certain things. I'll be interested to see how that looks like divorced from our current times. I think it's so ingrained in recent history that it might be hard to look at that as an objective thing. That might be weird. But I do think it might be weird. It might be sort of an odd thing that like we want to derive meaning from our purchases. You know, but I definitely think with millennials and Gen X, it'll be interesting to see whether Gen Z sort of fits into those patterns. But you know, people want to be perceived a certain way, and they want to tout their consumer choices as their way to express that. Whether that is a good thing or a bad thing, I don't know, but that does seem like the current trends.
Yeah. The thing I'm most like interested from a historical perspective is to see how that shifts, like to what degree does societal behavior and values change in an economy that's entirely, essentially a money that's essentially based on debt and then one that's based on like actual savings, like real value at the underneath it. Like everybody is not holding a liability, but they are holding an asset. And how
I think that'll be interesting. I still personally have some reservations about having Bitcoin compete in the arena of like sovereign monies in terms of, you know, what our expectations for it are. I think the other thing to remember about Bitcoin is like it's a super young technology. And I guess I would say this is my personal feeling, definitely not reflected in the report at all, but, you know, certainly I worry about us making, statements about Bitcoin as a safe haven, about Bitcoin as like an alternative to like gold and other things, especially when it's so young. While I think that those things could be true, you know, they also don't have to be true, right? I think it is. Mm-hmm. Will continue to propagate, and that the network creates the economic conditions under which it will continue. I think that is probably about as much as we've learned. Like, unfortunately, in 10 years, you know, it's important to remember we haven't really learned that much. And, you know, I don't know. I just think it'll be an interesting story of, you know, I think the current consumer trends in Bitcoin is, yeah, you see people kind of turning to it for ideology and then future, you know, the expectations of future value, right? Yeah. That has been the biggest driver of Bitcoin adoption, is that everybody thinks it will go up in the future. So when you're looking at wealth transfers, or, you know, we assume that these things will continue over time, right? So one of the assumptions of the report is that we assume in 2040, like, you know, people's assumption of Bitcoin is that the value will go up over time. They'll mm-hmm. want to invest in it because it'll be a better way for them to protect their money. Will that always be the case? Who knows, right?
Who knows?
I think we're definitely extrapolating under current conditions.
Yeah. It's funny with safe haven, like, I totally agree with you there, particularly in the context of like the safe haven concept. Like, I feel like it needs a couple of pretty glaring caveats, is that it's not a short-term or mid-term value safe haven, but that like, so whenever that comes up, I always kind of feel like I need to like kind of jump in and be like, no, what it's a safe haven as, just if it is a safe haven right now for anything, it's in the fact that you have assurances of its accounting system,
right?
Monetary
right,
yeah. properties, and that's,
well, you know, that you will only have X number of Bitcoin. Exactly. You don't know how much that exactly. X number of Bitcoin will be worth against other things. Like,
yeah, it could lose 50% of the day.
Right, we right. know that. So, yeah, that's kind of that's actually kind of a funny observation, that it's like, yeah, it's a halfway point between them. Like, yeah, it's like, yeah, in the future I will have the same number of Bitcoins that I have today. I don't
exactly
know what the value of this is.
We don't know what it's going to be worth. We think it's got, you know, a lot of conditions for long-term sustainability and the obviously massive potential for growth, but your assurances are not in the price in any short or midterm.
Well, I think, like, you know, I think it was maybe one of your recent podcasts, you were talking about sort of the environment for the inflation, like currently with all the recent money printing. And my worry would be that we go too far into the safe haven arguments, and then it becomes like, look, I mean, I'll be honest, like the limitations of my economic understanding is that I've learned economics through cryptocurrency. I don't really understand Keynesianism like as well as I should. And,
yeah,
you know, if we make it out of this crisis and, you know, the money supply seems stable and people don't notice, then, you know, we've really kind of gone hog wild on this whole money printer go burr thing. you know, I don't know if, you know, it's like, do we want to bet the house on that one?
Yeah.
You know, I'm certainly not qualified to make that decision on behalf of the community, but I think it'll be an interesting one to see play out.
Yeah, definitely. Particularly because those sorts of trends, like so many things can happen in the short term that completely contradict the long-term perspective, because these are very, very long-term trends and like societal shifts that just don't happen quickly. So you can see all sorts of chaos in the meantime. We just don't know where the chips are going to fall.
Yeah, even we had some internal debates, like, you know, whether Bitcoin is savings, right? Like, can you make this the statement that Bitcoin is a network for savings? Like, right? Like, and I think that's another super interesting current debate. Yeah, I think the current environment has added a lot of flavor to this conversation. I think, you know, 2-3 months ago, I think, you know, Bitcoin as a safe haven, Bitcoin as a protocol for savings. You know, those were things that got tossed around a lot in the current environment. Maybe a bit more unclear, but, you know,
things are a little spicier now.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, I do think that, you know, it'll be interesting to see what plays out with the next halving and whether we do see, you know, and I think this is a lot of what Beautyon was talking about back in the day, is that, you know, will Bitcoin continue to succeed and propagate and become more valuable again this time around? And I think it's interesting that, you know, you kind of see two schools of thought on that one. You see, okay, well, this has happened twice before, so it should happen again. And you see other people saying, well, you know, generally invest a large enough investment pool, you know, you'll see that trends get invalidated because people will bet on trends. So I think, yeah, another super interesting thing to see how that plays out. So
yeah, whatever trend kind of gets set or whatever could kind of reinforce itself because other people see the trend, you know.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure how much this sort of gets into the Bitcoin halving priced in argument, which I'm not sure. I don't know. Like, to me, the is Bitcoin halving priced in argument sort of assumes that most people understand Bitcoin, which I don't think is true. So I don't know how much I agree with that, but, you know, we'll see. So
yeah, we did. I read, was it Nick Carter? I think it was Nick Carter, had the EMH, the efficient market hypothesis, like a really good, like, kind of breakdown of that concept. And then 100 trillion USD kind of gave his response and how he thinks it's more of a risk assessment thing. But both of those were really great pieces that kind of like flew back and forth on that concept that I thought were just really fun digging into.
Yeah, I mean, what we've seen is that the scarcity of the Bitcoin network, like, you know, it's responded by getting more valuable periodically with you know, the US dollar. I mean, this time 4 years ago before the last halving, you know, price was $600, right? So you know, I think that, you know, I think, and definitely the report sort of assumes that, like, the technology will keep functioning like that, right? I think that's sort of a necessary precursor to you know, people you know, continuing to choose to put their savings into Bitcoin and to trust the Bitcoin network.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Now, in the report, it focuses on the millennials and Gen Xers.
Mm-hmm.
What are kind of all the factors you think that really make them so much more favorable, like them, us, our generations, so much more favorable to Bitcoin? Why is it that, like, I immediately am like, yeah, Bitcoin, and, you know, it takes me a year and a half to convince my dad or something, you know?
Yeah, I think that's just human nature. I think, you know, we're more familiar with the things that we grew up with, and we're more, you know, as we get older, we're more hesitant to things that we're new. I mean, I imagine you could have done a similar report and, you know, 30 years ago, and it would have found that older people didn't like fax machines, right? So,
yeah,
you know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, and this, you know, a lot of people have done some good memeing and tweeting about this over the years, right? Like, electricity was something that a lot of people, like, you know, older generations at the time, and there was public outcry over, you know, the dangers of filling our towns and cities with wires that, like, pipe, you know, essentially energy that could, you know, cause harm if it was, you know, mistreated. But now you'll think of nothing about, like, rolling over electricity wire with, like, your car tire, right? Like, you or stepping on it or whatever,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you have no relationship to, like, electricity being, like, dangerous to you, because I probably bet that, like, me and you, like, we've spent our entire lives within 3 feet of high voltage wire.
Something electrical,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, for, like, I mean, even just looking around, you know, an office or an apartment, right? You see hundreds of things that are piping electricity, but that was something that people were afraid of at the time. So, I think it's, that is just a function of technology, and that is not unique to Bitcoin. And that was the other thing that the report, I think, at the beginning tries to make the case for, is that, you know, technology trends, you know, they're not something that are unique to even the most recent centuries, right? You can go back to the 1800s and, you know, you have the steam engine and, you know, the factory and assembly line, like, right, these are all, you know, these are all mechanisms of technology that produce some efficiency. And I think, you know, really the report tries to view Bitcoin in the lineage of that, right? The efficiency here is now that we can move value at the speed of the internet, like using a system like Bitcoin. And that previously was impossible, right? Like what Bitcoin achieved prior to Bitcoin's creation had never previously occurred. you know, and I think it's important to remember that Bitcoin is an invention, like someone invented it. It invalidated something that was previously, you know, it's almost like you look at it every time in human history, you could have said like, you know, you can't move money like the internet, and it would have been true until Bitcoin was created, right? And it sort of took a law about the world and invalidated it.
And in
doing that, you know, has unlocked this new era where I think the world will have to adjust to, you know, what it has created. So
there's a wonderful book about the electricity and the fears and propaganda that went for and against it, like back in the day. So much fun stuff to explore, and it's called
What's the name of that one?
It's called AC/DC, the First Standards War, and it's about the giant battle between, you know, a Tesla and Westinghouse and Edison on what was going to be the electrical standard, and how they fought with each other and said, oh, the other one is the one that is dangerous or whatever. Like that's actually
right.
the electric chair was AC, was because Edison was trying to prove how dangerous AC current was. So he literally like talked with like politicians. He like went backdoored and everything to create an electric chair so that people would associate, it ran on AC current, so people would associate AC with killing people, with murder.
Wow, and that's fascinating.
That's where a lot of it came from. This is a fascinating book that like digs into all that stuff. I'm sure you'd be interested.
Yeah, definitely. I'll have to bookmark that one.
Even though the report really only kind of digs into millennials and Gen Xers, where do you kind of see Gen Z falling into all this? Like they've now lived in an era where do they what's their level of trust in, you know, government finance? Like, how do you see them?
Yeah, that's
a non-state currency.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the report definitely doesn't examine that, because I don't think, you know, consumer understanding of Gen Z, you know, is pretty early at this moment. There are some theories on that. A lot of the current writing talks about how you know, Gen Z is a little bit more, they don't really have the same relationship with internet services the way millennials and Gen X did, because, you know, millennials and Gen X, they had to make the internet better, right? There was like some period where they lived in a state where the internet was good for some things, right? Like I started with AOL, and I think Earthlink was like my first internet provider.
Earthlink.
Yeah, right. You know, they mail you the CDs, right? So I think like we lived in a state where the internet was improved and sort of contributed to that evolution, whereas I think some of the hypotheses now are that Gen Z sort of has existed outside of that, right? So their primary trends were like the social mobile disruption, in which, you know, it was very much focused on ease of use and accessibility via different devices. And I think the thinking on that is that they're going to be more maybe used to services that work for them rather than, you know, kind of, you know, helping some other technology along, which I don't know. I think it's still early, right? You know, I think the other observation that people have made is that whereas the millennials and Gen X were primarily affected by the Great Recession, Gen Z has not had an event like that. So, you know, we'll see what happens with this like current situation around coronavirus, like whether that is a similarly disaffecting thing for that population. I think we'll probably, you know, play a big role in that. you know, I've always had a thesis on this, which was sort of loosely like, you know, it'll be the children of Vitalik will be the people who kind of like really unlock the technology, right? Like there's, you assume like future generations will just intuitively understand this stuff better than us.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess unrelated to any data, I've always been personally excited on the fact that, you know, in a few years it will be likely that most people who are working in cryptocurrency will be people who, you know, essentially like we're from a very young age, like it just existed in the world as long as they have. And I think that's pretty exciting because I don't know what really that will bring, but I assume that they'll have a different perspective on it. You know, yeah. where will they identify in terms of their preferred crypto, you know, political affiliation or ideology? I think that also could be really interesting. So,
yeah, there's a, it'll be really interesting to see when we actually have like when we're pulling data from, you know, Gen Z, like when
right.
when we're really seeing what their perspective is. And you know, the one thing that just totally blew my mind, I had no idea, with the data point from the millennials was the popularity of the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust against like the other investments. I had no idea it was that high.
Yeah, that actually wasn't our research. I think that was something that came out pretty recently. But yeah, that is interesting, especially because I think there's like such a huge premium over the spot price for that.
Yeah, it's like it's like a chunk. Like it's like 20% or something like that. It's a pretty hefty premium. But it was like above Netflix and Microsoft. Right. That was just, you know, number five on the list. Like that's pretty crazy, you know?
Yeah, I think it'll definitely be interesting. I mean, I think that, we've definitely seen some people start to take interest in, you know, even my friends recently, you know, have been emailing, texting me a bit more about crypto and Bitcoin. I think, you know, I think we're always going to have these sort of like phases and cycles of adoption of cryptocurrency. You know, it doesn't seem like we're, you know, I think that's the other thing is like, I think we're going to be in this boom bust period for like a while, you know?
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
So, you know, every new boom is a, you know, some new Bitcoiners and crypto people are born. So.
Yeah. What's your take on, considering this is mostly focused on, or well, it's all focused on the great wealth transfer. Do you see that wealth at risk, like in kind of the current environment? Like what's your take on that? Is that something that you think is a long-term problem, or is this just kind of like a short-term adjustment?
You're talking about like the recent the bailouts crisis. And things like that?
Yeah. Bailouts and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So this kind of maybe gets a little bit in my personal limitations of, you know, being not a libertarian / Republican. And really, like I kind of came in from like the Obama left, I guess.
Okay.
So my, you know, I don't have that perspective on it, I guess. You know, with the current crisis, as I said, I think earlier, I think it's, you know, this is the Bitcoin safe haven argument is getting its proving point maybe a little bit earlier than warranted, right? And that's sort of the thing that I worry about is, you know, if you think of Bitcoin as a safe haven, which, you know, I do, I think it like meets some of those characteristics, like in finite supply, you can assume that it should, you know, trade, you know, if it matures correctly, it should trade again, you know, in ways where it's unaffected by these other things, like, you know, these macro markets. We're not seeing that play out because I think, you know, again, it's a startup safe haven, right? So, you know, it's an aspiring safe haven, not a mature one. Bitcoin getting a test like this early on is interesting. You know, I a few years ago made the decision to start saving in Bitcoin. I encourage other people to do that now because I think that is a good idea because I have been in Bitcoin it is true that historically the price of Bitcoin has gone up. And for a while I didn't have any exposure to it. So I guess when I look at the current situation, I try to backtrack and say, okay, like where have we gotten in the development of our arguments and where they've been successful. And I think that, you know, we have to kind of keep building on what's been working, and what's been working is definitely that, You know, Bitcoin is a place to store your wealth. It should provide relative safety from, you know, other monies, which are easily debased. And so we should, if those theses are true, see Bitcoin respond in the current situation, maybe not immediately, but it, you know, it should be sometime soon that we should see something like that. So I guess the thing that I'm watching in the market as someone, you know, more journalistic or research minded is will that happen, right? Do we see that? Mm-hmm. And if we don't see that, what happens, right? So I think people in cryptocurrency are very good at modulating their talking points. So I'm sure they'll find something new, but you know, it'll be curious to see how, like, whether that actually is preserved, or if it succeeds. Like, I don't know. I think it's it should escalate that. If you had asked me 4 or 5 months ago, I mean, I would have thought that that test for Bitcoin wouldn't come for a very long time.
Yeah, I thought we were still far off too. We had a Raleigh Bitcoin meetup that was basically very recently on Monday. It was basically around that whole idea. We had like 7 or 8 people come in. We were like, is Bitcoin ready for this? Like, it's kind of being thrown into the fire like immediately. But it's funny, with that 50% price drop, there was a really great explanation. Parker Lewis kind of hinted at the exact same concept, but on the Brink podcast recently was it's like Johnny, I can't remember the guy's name, unfortunately, but he said when people are getting margin called, when there's a lot of forced selling, the first thing that gets sold obviously is the bad stuff. But then what happens after that is when you're in forced selling is that when you can't sell the bad stuff, you sell what you can. And then shockingly out of this, like gold and Bitcoin were liquid assets. They were things that you could get to quickly and you could dump quickly to cover all of your other positions that are getting murdered.
Right.
And that's why
I thought the most fascinating data point of the whole thing was the Nick Carter, I think it was the Coinmetrics company did, where, you know, just the data on this, the most of the selling was from new buyers, newer buyers in Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And again, you see this sort of like the, you know, and I think that is the strength of the Bitcoin network right now is the, you know, the hodlers, right? Yeah, but that, you know, that is the, you know, the force of the network, right? Is that people are, you know, a large amount of the network was unfazed. But again, I think it's still something where, you know, Bitcoin might get thrown into a narrative just like a little bit earlier than, you know, maybe we don't see the big success from, you know, this debasement of government currency, and then, well, then how do you manage the argument from there, right? So you know, when I see something like the money printer go burr thing, it's like, you know, as a more conservative person, I've sort of been like, well, you know, what's your downside if like that argument isn't as successful in the short term? The downside is, well, now you've kind of chicken littled yourself, you know.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you avoid being like in the Bitcoin chicken little camp there? So
yeah, if we don't, like in the context of like a credit crunch or credit crisis, you're looking at money that literally vanishes from the system as, you know, defaults happen. And because the money is created by liability and or created as a loan. And if that loan doesn't get paid back, literally the money vanishes. So you could, even though they're, you know, money printer go burr, we could actually see deflation rather than inflation, particularly in the short to midterm.
Yeah, this is where when I last saw Seyfedean, I said that I feel like he flamed on Keynes so hard in that book that I need to go back and read Keynes. you know, my tendency is to just, you know, I think people should always explore like information and at the source. I mean, I don't know enough about his theories at this point to really feel comfortable laughing at him like everyone else. So I don't know. You know, I always say that, you know, reserve the right to, you know, access more information before forming an opinion.
Yeah. I like the strategy of, can I disprove what I currently think? Can I go find the information that makes me feel stupid about believing what I believe, which happens pretty frequently, to be honest.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, you know, I think the reason with this report being super long in scope is that, you know, I think it does take people a while to like wake up to Bitcoin and as like for what it is. I mean, you know, even drawing my experience, right, of being here for years and kind of not really identifying with any of the core tenants, like, as much, right? So I think it's, yeah, it's important to remember other people are going to go through those, their own versions of that curve. Yeah. You know, and so I think, you know, we are playing the long game here. You know, this is a generational transition, and so yeah, maybe the short term, it's maybe maybe we don't want to hype our Ali Frazier battle just yet.
Yeah, I think the 20 to 25 year time frame that like y'all kind of have is, it's kind of that internet time frame, right? Like, it's like, where do we see Bitcoin at the stage that the internet is today, like where we kind of think of it?
Yeah,
if so, that is a potential future.
Yeah, so my theory on this is that it's sort of the desensitization disruption. So I think, and this is definitely true of the millennials and maybe Gen X also, but we existed for most of our lives at a period where the internet was a mature enough technology such that, you know, like take the concept like serial entrepreneurism, right? So this is this idea that at one point in the 90s, like the internet was so disruptive that like single individuals could start multiple successful companies that were basically predicated on migrating existing services to the internet, right? So that's a huge, that, and I think really the context that's missing there for a lot of people is that that is a very specific point in the life cycle of a technology that comparatively to the overarching curve is very small. Like, so we've all spent our lives sort of in a period where the internet, and then by virtue of spawning like sort of the mobile social movements therein, has been eroding industries at a very fast rate. And I would say with cryptocurrencies, it's like, I don't think we're anywhere close to that curve. I think I question whether or not we'll see that in our lifetime. Like, I don't know where I fall in that personally, but I you know, I think eventually it'll get there. But, you know, we were sort of immersed in this idea where, you know, our idea of an entrepreneur is this like serial entrepreneur person who's like constantly starting these things are all successful, right? The idea that you can have, you know, a company that you start and then, you know, become a Facebook, like that isn't the reality of the cryptocurrency industry or Bitcoin at the moment. And so I think there is going to be some learning curve there, right? Like we did experience a very unique thing with the internet, and it might take us a long time to experience something like that again.
Gotcha. In that context, do you think that the internet is that technology that we should be comparing Bitcoin to? Do you see like an analogous technology that really that best illustrates that you kind of fall back on to kind of think about Bitcoin? Is it the internet or is it something else?
I don't think my answer is going to be very popular. I think that, you know, I honestly, when I've thought about this myself, I think that you have, like, you think about the telegraph, like, so I know you're not going to like this already, but like, you know, you went from like pigeons, like you went from like using pigeons to disseminate information. So, like, you know, you actually go back and study like the history of like news organizations, like that is what they did, right? So they like trained carrier birds to, you know, relay information around places.
So that's
how markets operated, right? And then at some point the telegraph was created and the information that you could transmit was now digitized to some degree, right? Through some sort of wire in the earth, right? So with Bitcoin, I do think it benefits from the internet because it is itself an internet derivative technology. But it's important to realize that like Bitcoin has also, in the way that the telegraph like literally took something that was non-digital and digitized it, it's like that leap, like, so if you look at the history of communications technology, right, it's like, what's the biggest leap, right? Like, is the biggest leap going from the landline phone or Facebook, or is it going from, you know, like where did the biggest thing occur? And I, like, honestly, I think it was probably with like the early telegraph systems, right? They built a cable underneath the Atlantic Ocean to run between London and New York that, like, you know, maybe could pass a few words like a minute, but like the light speed jump between that was so huge. And I think Bitcoin sort of is a light speed jump in that way, and that it, like, you know, it is impossible now to have a digital asset like in the way that Bitcoin is a digital asset that has value, and it has recreated the conditions under which that is now possible. So, you know, I don't know. I always like to kind of go back, and I like the telegraph analogy merely because it says that you know, the information communication curve, like, and then the history of that technology trend is really quite long.
Yeah, that's a really interesting. I don't think I don't like that. I think I like that fine, because it's a good it's a good demonstration of a fundamental shift, but with the caveat of clear limitations and room for improvement. Because, you know, like, we had the telegraph, which turned us, it basically gave us the first iteration of digital information and the first, I guess you could say, electrical, like, neural network sort of thing in across the globe. And then it wasn't for, you know, what, 80 odd years. And then suddenly we have packet switching, and we turned this infrastructure that we've been building into this entirely different mechanism.
Yeah, that's sort of why I question, like, whether or not Bitcoin is actually really, like, you know, that's why I sort of say, like part of it is the failure of, like, you know, language to describe things, right? So it's like, is Bitcoin an innovation? Like, and, like, I don't know, because an innovation sort of, it's like, I don't know, like Bluetooth innovation, like, I don't know, like, you know, Wi-Fi is an innovation.
And you subjectively, like, define what, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's like, whereas, like, an invention is like, you know, what's the difference of scale here, right? So the closest that I've come to it is that, like, an invention sort of overturns a truth about the world that was, like, previously true. So the one that I like to describe this is, you know, so when you think about the Wright brothers with flight, right?
Yeah.
So, like, prior to them flying, it was true that man could not fly, right?
Yeah.
It was, like, true at every point in time where it was, like, absolutely true. And then when they came out and they, you know, with their, they, you know, the, you know, I think there's some interesting stories in the time. It's like the scientific journals, like, refused to publish anything about the airplane because they just didn't believe that it was true, right? So, like, an invention sort of then overturned something that you previously thought was true, right? It's like such a strong innovation that, like, almost invalidates, like, a law of nature.
Yeah.
So, like,
that's great.
I think with Bitcoin, it's like, I think we need to start talking about Bitcoin as an invention. Like, on the scale of disruptive ideas, like, it possesses the qualities of the stuff that is, like, of the highest rather than, like, a derivative, like, content, right? Like, I guess, like, it should start a new trend of value exchange because that thing that it does was not possible.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, before it was like, you know, so you could say, like, now, like, starting another asset now is, like, unlikely or maybe prohibitively difficult, but it exists in, like, a wholly different environment where it's no longer impossible.
Yeah. That's interesting. No, I love that. And I'd probably agree, like, in trying to figure out trying to clarify the definition between the two, like, in the context of an invention, like, yeah, it made something possible that just wasn't, like, there was no real way for two people who didn't trust each other to come to agreement on, like, that kind of global consensus mechanism that was provable rather than reliant on trust. And,
well, so now you get into, like, the cool stuff, which is, yeah, like, what is the actual invention?
What is that invention?
Like, right? What does it do, right? And then I think the closest we're getting to that is that it, you know, preserves and protects a scarce asset. And, like, from what we've seen, you know, it creates a common digital good that, like, you know, previously that was impossible. So, you know, where that goes from here, I think, is, you know, obviously, like, why I continue to be really interested in cryptocurrency. But, you know, I always tell people, you know, I think we're talking about a long period of time. You know, I think we're going to see some, you know, big highs and, you know, some lower lows. Right now we're in sort of lean times. So, I mean, I certainly think, like, you know, the future is exciting, and I hope that that's what the people get from the report.
I'll be directing people. I thought about doing an audio version, but I think there's too much data to it's so hard to get, like, the charts across. I feel like I may still end up trying to do audio for it. We'll see, because it's really good. For now, we'll link everybody to it, because there's a lot of visuals and a lot of stuff to go into for, you know, the different tax brackets and, like kind of what we may be able to predict as far as some rudimentary price prediction from a certain set of conditions moving forward, whether it's static or changes a little bit.
Well, cool, man.
Yeah, I wanted to, real quick, like, what, I know we're kind of getting to the end of time here. What are you guys working on next? Like, are y'all going to be taking this same sort of research, like, and applying it to different areas other than the quote unquote great wealth transfer?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, with Kraken Research, definitely we want to be providing value to the current conversation in terms of, you know, what people are talking about. So, you know, not sure if we're going to stick with Bitcoin next or, you know, do something mm-hmm. else. But, you know, I think hopefully what people see with this is that, you know, we're looking to kind of change their perspective or give them a different framework to look at things. So, you know, don't want to give too much away just yet, but, people can go to blog.kraken.com or, you know, we're at KrakenFX on Twitter and, yeah, definitely hoping to do some more stuff. So.
Awesome. Well, I'll keep an eye on it. I'll be, reading it. Feel free to DM me anything that y'all publish, cause I'd love to stay on top of it.
Great.
All right. Well, cool, dude. Pete, thanks for coming on the show. I enjoyed this. This was a lot of fun.
Fun conversation, man. And yeah, hope to stay in touch.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, man. Take it easy.
All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Hope you guys enjoyed that chat. Again, that was with Pete Rizzo. I've got the link in the show notes and on the Twitter share. I'll put to the Kraken blog so you can actually download and look at the full report. Again, there's a lot of data and charts and stuff to look at. So definitely worth going to check out and actually getting a visual look at what's going on. Another huge thank you to Pete for coming on the show. Really fun discussion. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And a thanks to Swan Bitcoin for helping make this show happen, supporting the Audible of the Bitcoin space. I got a lot of things coming, so everybody stay tuned. Just finally getting up. Finished up on a video that we worked on with a couple of guys with the Raleigh Bitcoin crew. I had a lot of just random fun filming some stuff one day and a lot of great reads lined up for the rest of the week. So stay tuned, subscribe to the Crypto Economy. I'll catch you all tomorrow with another episode. And until then, take it easy, guys.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.